Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. This week, we're reading from the September 29th issue of the Week. The cover drawing for this week looks like it's set in the hall of a typical high school. You see double-stacked blue lockers down each wall. In the foreground is Florida Representative Matt Gaetz. He's wearing jeans, T-shirt. He's got a, I guess I'd call it a varsity jacket with the letters FC on it. I think that stands for Freedom Coalition. And he's got House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy in a headlock under one arm. And then with his other hand, he's giving him what I would call noogies, rubbing his knuckles on his head. Typical high school scene. Anyway, the headline is Bullied by the Right. Can McCarthy stop GOP hardliners from shutting down the government? That is our first main story. We will start right there. Shutdown odds rise amid GOP infighting. What happened? A government shutdown looked increasingly likely this week as warring House Republicans failed to pass even a stopgap measure loaded with spending cuts that Senate Democrats were certain to reject. With government funding set to expire on September 30th, members of the far-right Freedom Caucus huddled with more moderate House Republicans to craft a 31-day extension that would cut non-defense programs by 8% and impose strict border restrictions. But at least 16 GOP hardliners rejected the measure, saying the proposed cuts were too shallow and demanding additional language targeting woke policies and the weaponization of the Department of Justice. It's a surrender to Joe Biden, said Florida Representative Matt Gaetz. Republican disarray was underlined when five hard-right conservatives joined Democrats to block a Republican bill funding the Defense Department, normally a GOP priority. I like a challenge, said House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. I don't like this big a challenge, but we're just going to keep doing it until we can make it. As the GOP rebels dug in, some angry moderates openly considered ending the impasse by joining with Democrats to pass a short-term funding plan. Some of these folks would vote against the Bible because there's not enough Jesus in it, said Representative Don Bacon, Republican from Nebraska, adding that it's time to work across the aisle. But any such deal would almost certainly prompt a vote to oust McCarthy as Speaker. Gaetz said any stopgap bill at all would be an automatic trigger for a removal motion. White House spokesman Ian Sams called on House Republicans to drop these silly political Washington games and actually do their job to prevent a government shutdown. What the editorial said. A deal to avert a shutdown already exists, said the Washington Post. McCarthy and President Biden met on the true middle ground in May, with Democrats agreeing to $180 billion in cuts over the next 2 years in exchange for Republicans raising the debt ceiling. Lawmakers should simply honor those spending levels, but GOP bomb throwers are demanding a do-over, and McCarthy is accommodating them. If there's no breakthrough soon, he'll need to find votes across the aisle to push through a deal. Bigger spending cuts are needed to rein in our runaway national debt, which hit a whopping $33 trillion this week, said the New York Post. But blowing up House Republicans' narrow four-seat majority is a step in the wrong direction. Instead of being guided by principle or pragmatics, Gaetz and his faction are playing for social media hits and self-aggrandizement. With voters likely to blame Republicans for a shutdown, such narcissistic nihilism only guarantees a loss for the team and the nation. What the columnist said. I never thought I'd utter these words, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. Matt Gaetz is right. It's easy to vilify GOP extremists as they act out like unruly teens, but blame for the current chaos falls squarely on McCarthy, who won the speakership by promising to champion their policies and to allow a single malcontent to raise a motion to depose him. The House Speaker created this right-wing monster to serve his own ambitions and is flailing now that it's demanding its due. We're entering a land of the unknown, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. Even if McCarthy was willing to give the far right what it wanted, it's not clear what that would look like. Does de-weaponizing the Justice Department mean defunding the FBI? When such demands are inevitably not met, the fringe will move to oust McCarthy. His best defense is the fact that no House Republican is more popular within the GOP conference and that no one else would want a job where hardliners can threaten to shoot you at any moment. We could be headed for a record-breaking shutdown, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. Even if McCarthy ekes out a stopgap measure, there will then be talks with Senate Democrats and the White House, with the two sides far apart and a sizable Republican bloc opposed to any compromise at all. If no deal is struck before September 30th, it's unclear what will change in October or November. So prepare for images of a darkened Capitol, furloughed workers, and shuttered national parks. Might we crush the record of a 35-day shutdown set in 2018-19? Right now, it's a distinct possibility. Controversy of the week. Hunter Biden. Are his gun charges political? Something really stinks here, said Harry Littman in the Los Angeles Times. Hunter Biden was indicted by special counsel David Weiss last week on three gun charges connected to his lying on a 2018 application to buy a handgun. President Biden's son said he plans to plead not guilty, though there is little doubt he entered some mistruths on the firearm form. Hunter stated that he was not using illegal drugs, despite, as his 2021 memoir makes clear, being addicted to crack cocaine at the time. Still, prosecutors rarely file charges for this offense unless an improperly obtained gun is used to commit other crimes. More to the point, Weiss agreed just last month to drop the gun charges if Biden entered a non-custodial diversion program. The facts of Biden's crime didn't magically become more serious in recent weeks, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. What changed is that his plea deal fell apart for unrelated reasons, and Weiss, appointed U.S. attorney in Delaware by former President Donald Trump, came under intense pressure from Republicans desperate for something, anything they can use to tarnish the Biden name before next year's election. Make no mistake, Hunter is a deeply flawed man who made many bad decisions. But he wouldn't be facing up to 25 years in prison for lying on a form if he weren't the president's son. These charges are political, all right, said Quinn Hillier in the Washington Examiner. They're a work of performance art to protect the Bidens. The odds of Hunter spending even a day in jail for this trifling crime are remote, but the superficially aggressive indictment lets Democrats cry persecution while hoping voters forget that Weiss mysteriously let the statute of limitations expire on more serious suspected tax violations. Meanwhile, a plethora of other possible offenses have been ignored, including soliciting prostitution and the alleged use of shell corporations for money laundering. None of this means that Hunter is actually guilty of those offenses, only that prosecutors seem suspiciously loath to pay the slightest attention to an abundance of indicators of corruption. One problem with such conspiracy theories, said David French in the New York Times, is that Hunter's defense could end up undermining a key element of federal gun regulations. Hunter's attorneys already say they'll challenge the constitutionality of the law against drug users buying firearms. They cite the Supreme Court's recent ruling, decried by the elder Biden, that gun control laws are invalid unless rooted in longstanding history and tradition. Usefully for Hunter, prohibitions on drug use and gun possession largely date to the 20th century. This puts conservatives in an awkward position, said Jacob Solman in Reason. They may loathe Hunter Biden, but they should root for him to beat this case and help uphold the right to bear arms. It's wrong that Hunter is being punished for a crime others haven't been, said Robert J. Spitzer in CNN.com. But that doesn't mean the law is wrong. Rather than undermine current restrictions, the glare of a high-profile trial next year may help the courts and the public appreciate the real dangers of letting drug users buy guns and the need for those who lie on gun applications to face punishment. The Hunter case could change American gun law, said Mike Mamoli in NBCNews.com. What troubles White House aides far more is that by draining his father's attention and focus in the run-up to a razor-close election, Hunter's legal woes could end up changing American history. It was a good week for keeping it real. After country singer Oliver Anthony, who shot to fame with his blue-collar anthem Rich Men North of Richmond, canceled a Tennessee concert because the venue was charging $99 a ticket. These are supposed to be affordable shows, he said. It was a good week for alpinists, who can now help themselves to free poop bags at rock climbing sites across the Squamish region of British Columbia. A local climbing society said the area has been struggling with human waste issues, particularly in our more remote crags. And it was a good week for to-go cups. After storage tanks burst at a distillery in the Portuguese town of Lavira, causing 580,000 gallons of red wine to flow through the streets. It looked like a river, said the distillery boss, adding that there was no lingering odor because it was good quality wine. But it was a bad week for fresh starts in 5784. After Donald Trump marked Rosh Hashanah with a social media post offering a quick reminder to those liberal Jews who voted to destroy America and Israel that they should make better choices moving forward. Happy New Year. It was a bad week for Floridians, whose very way of life is under threat from a proposed state bill that would require safety training to operate a boat and increase the penalties for boating while intoxicated. Florida leads the nation in boating fatalities with 65 in 2022. Finally, it was a bad week for robot waiters, who are apparently losing jobs to other robots, at least in South Korea. We are worried that cheap Chinese robots are dominating our market, one robotics executive told the Financial Times. It is difficult to compete with them on prices. The title of the briefing this week is A Superpowers Slump. After 40 years of explosive growth, China's economy is now in deep distress with no turnaround in sight. What's going wrong in China? The country's economy has hit a wall, ending the longest running boom in history. Since the ruling Communist Party embraced Western-style trade, investment, and market forces in the late 1970s, China has doubled the size of its economy every decade. Some 800 million Chinese have been lifted out of poverty, and the once largely rural nation has been transformed into a manufacturing colossus and America's only superpower competitor. But China's economy is now decelerating sharply, with gross domestic product growing at 3% last year, dropping from 7.4% a decade earlier. Exports are sagging, consumer spending is down, private investment has dropped by a quarter since 2020, and fears of a deflationary spiral are rising. China's debt is now nearly four times bigger than its GDP, and a burst housing bubble has left up to 80 million apartments unoccupied, threatening the savings of millions of Chinese who invested in the real estate market. We're witnessing a gear shift in what has been the most dramatic trajectory in economic history, said Columbia University economic historian Adam Tooze. Young people have been hit especially hard by the slowdown. How are young Chinese affected? As companies have cut back on hiring, the urban employment rate for 16 to 24-year-olds has doubled over the past 4 years to a record 21.3%. Meanwhile, a record 11.6 million students graduated from college this summer into an economy that's desperately short of high-paying white-collar jobs. President Xi Jinping has said youth must learn to eat bitterness, a Chinese expression that means suck it up and lower your expectations. It's a devastating blow for a generation raised to believe that hard work would yield success, and media stories abound about disillusioned youth who are lying flat or opting out of the rat race. They said our future would be bright and beautiful, Yin, a 24-year-old medical student, told the BBC, but our dreams have been shattered. What's driving the downturn? It's partly a consequence of Xi's three-year zero COVID policy, which was abandoned in January. Months-long lockdowns in Shanghai and other cities strangled production, led to mass layoffs, and spooked foreign buyers who relied on Chinese manufacturers to feed supply lines. But many of the country's woes predated the pandemic. China for decades rode a wave of growth created by putting the rural poor to work in urban factories. But it failed to build a strong consumer economy, which could have picked up the slack when exports slowed and factories started moving abroad to poorer countries. Local governments also goosed the economy by constructing skyscrapers, highways, high-speed rail lines, bridges, and airports. But they are running into diminishing returns in building stuff, said Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff. Overbuilding has left parts of China saddled with unpopulated ghost cities, underused infrastructure. Guizhou, one of the nation's poorest provinces, has more than 1,700 bridges and 11 airports and piles of debt. What is Beijing doing? Not enough, say economists. Some argue that Beijing should strengthen the country's weak safety net and embark on a stimulus program to shore up consumer spending and create jobs. But growing debt is an obstacle, as is Xi's aversion to welfareism that he says breeds laziness. Beijing has invested heavily in the superconductor and electric vehicle industries, and the latter is a notable bright spot. UBS analysts expect China's share of the global auto market to roughly double to 33% by the end of the decade. But those sectors can't lift the entire economy. Analysts say that in the face of economic woes, Xi's government has two choices: to expand economic opportunity or to ratchet up repression. They say it's taken the latter path, which stands to worsen China's plight by further stifling innovation and growth. Are Xi's policies harming the economy? The president's increasing authoritarianism appears to be deterring foreign investors, who spent $20 billion in China in the first quarter of 2023, down from $100 billion in the same period last year. Many Western companies are worried about getting caught in the growing superpower showdown between the U.S. and China. Beijing banned semiconductors from U.S. chip firm Micron earlier this year, and in April sent police to the office of U.S. consulting giant Bain & Company. At the same time, Xi has been waging a regulatory crackdown on Chinese big tech firms that might challenge his power. Reports from China now suggest a broad lack of confidence among citizens that their government can lead the way forward. The most terrifying thing is that everyone around me is at a loss of what to do next, said Richard Lee, owner of a struggling auto parts business. Such despair creates risks that go beyond China's economy. What kind of risks? Masses of disaffected, unemployed young people pose a threat to an authoritarian regime, and Xi well knows it. Many experts fear that China's growing woes could prompt more repression at home and more aggression abroad. Efforts to change the subject could extend to invading Taiwan. In March, Xi called reunification with the island the essence of national rejuvenation. President Biden last month called China's economic stumbles a ticking time bomb that should concern the U.S. When bad folks have problems, he said, they do bad things. Reading a few of the best columns of the week. I think we'll go ahead and take all three of them from the U.S. this week. First up, why Paxton survived impeachment. The acquittal of the most corrupt attorney general in Texas history is proof that pretty much anything goes in our state's politics, said the Houston Chronicle. Attorney General Ken Paxton, a far-right extremist who aligned himself with Donald Trump, had been impeached by the Republican-controlled State House on 16 charges of bribery, unfitness for office, and abuse of office in connection with his corrupt relationship with Austin real estate developer Nate Paul. Paxton was accused of intervening in a federal investigation of Paul, who then remodeled Paxton's house and created a make-work job for a woman with whom Paxton was having an affair. When disgusted whistleblowers in Paxton's own office exposed his corruption, Paxton fired them and then shamelessly used $3.3 million in taxpayer funds to settle their lawsuit. The impeachment triggered a bitter internecine war with the Texas GOP. Senate Republicans acquitted him after the MAGA faction and two West Texas oil billionaires who fund many Republican campaigns sided with Paxton. He still faces a federal investigation on his dealings with Paul and felony securities fraud charges dating to 2015. In Texas, where honest leadership is scarce, democracy and decency have lost once again. Democrats must act on asylum. The border crisis has only one solution, said Fareed Zakaria. With apprehensions at the southern border rising and overwhelmed northern cities like New York and Chicago facing waves of migrants arriving by bus, President Biden needs to suspend entirely the admission of asylum seekers while the system digests the millions of immigration cases already pending. The asylum system has been broken by that massive backlog of cases. Biden tried requiring asylum seekers to apply from their home countries or through a digital app. But instead of going through that arduous, lengthy process, many have resumed crossing the border illegally and then claiming asylum, knowing a decision could take years. From March 2021 to August 2022, the government released more than 1 million migrants into the country, losing track of over 177,000. Asylum was created for victims of political and religious persecution, not people fleeing poverty, violence, and crime, who number in the millions. But the Biden administration is scared to take on its progressive wing. So far, its efforts have amounted to Band-Aids on a massive open wound. If Democrats don't take drastic action, immigration will provide rocket fuel for the populist right and help reelect Donald Trump. When women fear getting pregnant, abortion bans in red states have struck fear in the hearts of young women about getting pregnant, said Lauren Leader. Since the Supreme Court's deeply unpopular Dobbs ruling, 14 states have near-total abortion bans, and others have introduced strict limits, worsening an already grim maternal health care landscape in the U.S., where mortality rates are much higher than in other wealthy nations. A recent poll by my organization, All In Together, helped to conduct found 34% of women under 40 said they or someone they know decided not to get pregnant out of concern that they could not get proper care if something went wrong. In recent months, news stories have detailed women enduring horrific medical trauma in states where doctors fear criminal charges for ending troubled pregnancies. Those stories have penetrated the psyche of young people everywhere, even in blue states. Many were already ambivalent about having children, and with government intruding in their reproductive choices, they're opting out. In a country where birth rates have been falling for decades, this is not good news. The attempt to force women to give birth is backfiring. Many women who might want children have become too afraid to have them. The last word, our in-depth article, the weddings of the 1%. All the neuroses and financial squabbles of the rich came out around one very special moment, said Xochitl Gonzalez in The Atlantic, the day their daughters get married. Sunday mornings for wedding planners are reserved for prayer, not because it's a particularly pious profession, but because that's the day when clients who were married on Saturday figure out if they're happy or not. Should they choose unhappiness, Sunday is when they decide whom to blame, and Monday is when the emails come. Will the email be full of joy and praise, or will it be one of complaint? Back when I was a luxury wedding planner in New York City, my business partner and I once got an email from a bride, written as she helicoptered off to her honeymoon, saying that her wedding had been a transcendent experience. A call from the bride's mother directly followed. "Repeat after me," she said. "I am bad at my job. I should never do this job again." Sometimes the clients just need to vent. Sometimes they threaten to sue. The work of a luxury wedding planner is only partly about the planning. Yes, you can help the couple plan what you hope will be a stunning event, but your main job is to be a professional wedding friend. You're the person who cares if the bow on the favor has swallowed or inverse tails, or if the maid of honor is being a passive-aggressive bitch when none of the bride's other friends want to talk about it anymore. The family is paying you to care as much as they do. When I became a wedding planner, no one in my own family could comprehend my utility. My grandparents, who raised me, had what was called a football wedding. They rented the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall in Red Hook, Brooklyn, and piled tinfoil-wrapped heroes on a table. People would shout out which sandwich they wanted, and another guest would toss it across the room. How complicated could a wedding be, they wondered. Had I chosen to be a professional mud wrestler, I do not think it could have confounded them more. Whenever one of our events was featured in a bridal magazine, I would bring it to family occasions and show it off the way other people might show off pictures of their babies. Unfortunately, this just added to the confusion. Don't they realize they could have bought a house with all of this money? I would have to explain that my clients didn't need a house. They already had one. They probably had several. A few years after the recession, I did a lavish wedding on Long Island. The bride was stressing about putting a custom lining on her invitations. That would add another couple thousand to the already large stationery bill. She and the groom had been given a seven-figure sum to spend both on their wedding and on buying and decorating their new home, and the bride had a thing for mid-century modern furniture. Was the liner worth more than the Wasilli chair? She went back and forth, back and forth. I couldn't say a thing, but finally her mother reached her limit. "We're rich," she cried out in exasperation. "Get the liners." Months later, the same mother, while admiring the tent we had spent days erecting for the reception, said, in total seriousness, "I hate that it's only being used for one night. I wish we could find some homeless people to stay here when we're done." I once got a call from a woman in a panic. Her daughter was getting married in a few weeks, and she needed my partner and me to save this wedding. She offered no further details over the phone, insisting that we come to her uptown to her apartment so she could properly convey the scale of the conundrum. Right before she hung up the phone, she whispered, "By the way, I'm very, very rich." And she was. She lived in one of those opulent places with an elevator that opened up into the apartment itself, because that's how sprawling it was. A maid in a uniform greeted us and escorted us down a long art-lined hallway and into the library where the mother of the bride was waiting. She explained the dilemma. Her daughter was embarrassed by her family's wealth and had been living as a closeted rich person for years. Her friends had no idea. The bride had refused to let her mother have anything to do with the wedding because if her mom got involved, the jig would be up. Everyone would see she'd just been cosplaying poverty. And so, armed with information from the internet and her mother's checkbook, the young woman had gone off and planned what she imagined was an average wedding. With the event just weeks away, the mother had started poking around and realized, this is terrible. Her daughter didn't just have conflicted ideas about her own privilege, she also had bad taste, or at least unfortunate notions of what the average bride wants at her wedding. Things like jam jars for wine glasses, picnic tables for seating, a limited bar. Her daughter could pretend all she wanted, the mother said, but their friends and family knew that they were rich and were expecting a nice affair. After much argument, they compromised. They would hire a wedding planner, and the only wedding planner in all of New York they could agree on was me. Probably because while many of my competitors were specializing in opulence, I had cornered the market in understated luxury. The mother insisted that we meet right away because the bride was planning to reach out and hire us the next day. And the mother wanted me to be clear on how it was going to work. My job, in addition to making sure the wedding was not an embarrassment, was to say yes to everything the daughter asked for. If the bride questioned what something cost, I was to say it was already included in the contract. The mother didn't care how expensive anything was. She would cover it secretly. Did this sound crazy? Absolutely. Did I need the money? Yes. I was amazed by how well the strategy worked. You could serve these baby lamb chops, I would say, to which the bride would reply, but is that going to be more expensive than pigs in a blanket? And I would assure her, as I had been hired to do, that everything was in the contract. They say that there are no accidents, but the daughter, in town for the wedding things, logged onto her mother's computer and saw our email exchanges. For Christ's sake, the mother wrote, why can't you be my daughter? The mother said she'd grown up poor like me, but unlike me, had married well. Marry rich, she would tell me. It's so fun. She insisted, quite understandably, that I be fired immediately. The mother, it turned out, couldn't bring herself to fire me. We'd had a blast together upgrading the bride's budget-conscious twee affair into a jewel box of an event, and we weren't ready to quit. Instead, we came up with a ruse, even more elaborate than the first, to get us through the wedding day. I had one of my employees pretend to work for the caterer, and, I'm not particularly proud of this, we introduced the bride and this woman, assuring her that I was no longer involved. Except that I absolutely was. And nothing the bride and this woman talked about held any water, because the only thing that mattered was what happened between me and her mother. And what was happening was a lot. We ordered custom furniture to maximize the space in the room. We brought in an enhanced cooling system. We had the floor refinished so that no one would trip. On the day of the event, after straightening every fork and folding every hem-stitched linen napkin, I made myself invisible. I left everything in the trusted hands of a few of my staff members who were disguised as waiters. I posted myself in a restaurant a few blocks away and fielded the mother's hysterical text. She's going to find out. She's going to find out what we've been doing. I assured her that this charade would soon be behind us, but I didn't realize the reason she was certain her daughter would find out was that she was going to get drunk and tell her. Halfway through the reception, she pulled the bride aside and confessed the entire scheme. At the end of the night, my phone buzzed one last time. She knows everything. This is goodbye. Michael Wazer is among the most expensive caterers in the country. Stupid expensive, I've heard people call him. The prices start at $550 per person for dishes like foraged mushrooms under a quail egg and shaved black truffles. Nonetheless, Wazer told me, we are always going to be the help. I'm probably the most expensive help there is, but I'm the help, right? And I think that you have to remember that. I was used to my wealthy clients thinking they could bend reality to their will, but I got truly taken advantage of only once. The bride called us to say that she and her younger sister were both getting married in the same year at the same venue, for what seemed like obvious reasons, and she did not want to work with the same planner as her baby sibling. I quoted her our rates, and there was silence. Her sister's planner, she said then, was cheaper, something like $12,000 less. To which I replied, good for your sister. We nevertheless agreed to meet, and by the end of our coffee date, I could see by the needy look in her eyes that she wanted me to be her wedding best friend, the one person who didn't care about what her sister was doing with her wedding, the one person who didn't care that her sister was getting married, period. Her mother called. They loved me, but the issue was that the other planner cost less. Again, I said, good for you. They were welcome to use that planner for both events, but they wanted me. Eventually, they signed the contract and sent the first of several deposits. 2 weeks before the wedding, we called to remind them that the final payment of $10,000 hadn't come in yet. They said the check was in the mail. 2 days before we left to begin setting up, we tried to charge their card on file, but it was no longer valid. When we rang, they told us they would give us a check when we arrived. 3 days into the tent installation, when we would ask for the payment, The mother or father would say they would go to the house right away and get it. Each time they would get distracted. On the day of the wedding, we still hadn't been paid and debated what to do. It is easier to get a divorce than to quit a wedding. I know because I successfully did the former, but never the latter. Obviously, we showed up. When we asked the father for the check, he barked at us. How dare we harass him on his daughter's wedding day? But the day after, when we arrived to break down the party, the family was nowhere to be found. No check, no credit card number. We made the trip back to New York bathed in shame. 13 years in business, and we've been played by multimillionaires. That Sunday, we prayed extra hard, but on Monday, the bride's father reached out. He had made a list of minor infractions that he believed entitled him to withhold our last payment. Napkins not up to snuff, lights flickering in the restroom trailer. I called him and said this was simply not right. We had done what we were hired to do, but he had decided, it seemed clear to me, that if the little sister's wedding planner was taking less, I would have to take less as well. Contract be damned. Go ahead and fight me, he said. I'll have so much fun spending my money suing you. You might not be surprised to hear that after the mother of my fake poor bride told me it was farewell forever, it wasn't quite. I got some emails, the occasional text. The strange part about it is, although I believe the bride had every right to be upset, I never felt guilty for what we did. And I suspect that her mother didn't either. Our bond had nothing to do with how she felt about her daughter, and everything to do with how she felt about her money. Just fine. She not only didn't mind having it, she didn't mind spending it. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in The Atlantic. Read a couple of the health and science pieces this week. Signs of life on a distant planet. NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has spotted tentative hints of life on a colossal faraway world. The uninspiringly named K2-18b, more than eight times the size of Earth and about 120 light years away, appears to be what's known as a Hycean exoplanet, a planet outside our solar system with a hydrogen-rich atmosphere and oceans of liquid water. Even more exciting, the planet also exhibits a possible signature of dimethyl sulfide, or DMS, a molecule that on Earth is primarily produced by living phytoplankton in the oceans. It's the first Hycean planet ever identified, as well as the first time DMS has been detected on another planet. But researchers emphasize that the findings are preliminary, noting that a claim in 2020 that Venus harbored phosphine, another molecule related to life, has since been widely discredited. Traditionally, the search for life on exoplanets has focused primarily on smaller rocky planets. Lead author Niku Madhusudan from the University of Cambridge tells CBSNews.com. But the larger Hycean worlds are significantly more conducive to atmospheric observations. The James Webb Telescope is able to detect the presence of chemical molecules millions of miles away by analyzing the light that passes through a planet's atmosphere. By splitting the light into its different frequencies, like a prism creating a rainbow, scientists can see which parts of the spectrum are absent and therefore which chemicals in the atmosphere are causing that absence. Why our brains shrank. Human brains grew in volume almost fourfold in the past 2 million years, but in the more recent past, they have been shrinking. It was thought that the change began about 10,000 years ago, when the advent of farming changed our diets. But new research based on fossil and modern brain data suggests the shrinkage actually started much later, between 3,000 and 5,000 years ago. The researchers think the evolutionary driving force was the development of complex societies, which meant humans began relying on collective intelligence rather than individual knowledge. We're so social that we don't have to know everything anymore, co-author Jeremy Da Silva from Dartmouth College tells the Wall Street Journal. We collectively operate as a pretty functional society. Da Silva and his colleagues calculated that our brains have decreased in volume by about 10% over this period, or by roughly the size of a lime. But he emphasizes that size alone does not dictate smarts, and that our brains have probably become more efficient. Computers used to be the size of a room, he says, and now they fit into your pocket. And we're on the Talking Points page. Should have time for at least a couple of these articles. Start with Romney, A Complicated Legacy. Senator Mitt Romney's announcement last week that he won't run for re-election in 2024 is a loss for America, said David Jolly in MSNBC.com. And another nail in the coffin of the traditional GOP. The Utah Republican has been a pillar of dignity during the Trump era, opposing his party's evolution into a power-hungry movement bent on undermining our institutions. He's blasted fellow Republicans, he says, have put policies above the interest of liberal democracy and the Constitution. And he's been a savage critic of Donald Trump, distinguishing himself as the sole Senate Republican who twice voted for the former president's impeachment. Working with centrist Democrats to craft agreements on infrastructure and gun control, he has offered vision amid chaos and statesmanship amid pettiness. Even in announcing his retirement, Romney showed decency, stepping into the national conversation around elderly politicians and explaining that at age 76, it was time to step aside for a new generation of leaders. Romney is no profile in courage, said Philip Klein in National Review. He's an opportunist whose career has been defined by shape-shifting. As the GOP's 2012 presidential nominee, he morphed from a pro-choice moderate to a fire-breathing conservative, shifting his stances on guns, abortion, and immigration. While courting the Republican base, Romney pandered to the right-wing rage and resentment that eventually found its champion in Trump, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. He gave Trump much-needed mainstream credibility when he accepted the reality TV star's endorsement in the 2012 GOP primary. And after warning that Trump might lead the nation into the abyss during the 2016 presidential race, Romney dined with Trump following his election victory in a shameless bid to become Secretary of State. The senator isn't leaving quietly, said Jennifer Blahar in National Review. Romney has been working on a book that will be his final political testament, in which he excoriates Republicans who embrace Trump publicly while scorning him in private. The narrative of a conservative who sees the light is catnip for liberal sensibilities, but with a blind spot for his own faults, his preaching reeks of unearned sanctimony. Grappling with Romney's mixed legacy is a reminder that no politician is perfect, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. But at critical moments, only some rise to the occasion. Romney may be flawed, but he showed uncommon patriotism, integrity, and valor in a dark time. History will treat him well. COVID, should you get the new shot? Should you roll up your sleeve for the new COVID booster, asked Drew Couleur in The New Yorker. Although the COVID emergency is over, the virus is still evolving and circulating as an endemic infectious disease. Cases are spiking as fall arrives, and hospitalizations nationwide have nearly tripled since late June. Yet few Americans seem to care about taking any COVID precautions, and only 17% took last year's COVID boosters. The new mRNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna target a version of Omicron that was dominant months ago. But tests show they generate antibodies effective against other Omicron strains now in circulation. Getting periodic shots is important, since protection against serious illness and death wanes 4 to 6 months after a shot or a COVID infection. To combat vaccine fatigue, health officials are discouraging the term booster, positioning periodic shots not as a novelty, something to be dissected and debated, but as a routine occurrence, like an annual flu shot. COVID continues to present risks for people of all age groups, said Leanna S. Wynn in the Washington Post, which is why the Centers for Disease Control recommends all Americans get the latest shot. Vaccination will make COVID milder, even for healthy young people, and it also lowers the risk of developing long COVID, the lingering symptoms of fatigue, brain fog, and pain that haunt some people for months. But 88% of COVID deaths have occurred among people 65 and older, so it's seniors and other vulnerable people who really should get this latest shot. Younger, healthy people can decide in consultation with their physicians. Not according to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, said Andrew Warren in the Daily Beast. The shameless DeSantis is now trying to boost his foundering presidential campaign by actively discouraging Floridians from getting the new shots, saying they'd be guinea pigs for a vaccine that hasn't been proven to be safe and effective, which is utterly false. Florida has one of the oldest populations of any state, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and is now leading the nation in new COVID hospitalizations. But the desperate demagogue DeSantis has gone full anti-vaxxer to pander to the GOP's anti-science base. How many people will die needlessly this fall because of the politically poisonous big lie about vaccines? We'll read some of the short notes, starting with as much as $135 billion in fraudulent pandemic unemployment insurance claims were likely paid out from April 2020 to May 2023, according to new estimates by the Government Accountability Office. That equates to about 15% of total unemployment benefits distributed during the pandemic. The U.S. last week recorded its 500th mass shooting of the year, with five people left wounded after an attack in Denver. Hours later, one person was killed and five others wounded in the 501st mass shooting in El Paso, Texas. Until 2020, the country had never recorded 500 mass shootings in a year. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the Democrat from New York, has asked the chamber's sergeant-at-arms to stop enforcing the chamber's unofficial dress code. Senators are traditionally required to wear business attire, typically a suit and tie for men, shoulder covering dresses or pantsuits for women on the floor. Freshman Senator John Fetterman, the Democrat from Pennsylvania, favors shorts and hoodies and has circumvented the dress code by voting from the doorway of the Democratic cloakroom. Americans spent some $30 billion on legal marijuana last year. By comparison, $28 billion was spent on craft beer $20 billion on chocolate and $7 billion on ice cream. On the poll watch, only 34% of registered voters think President Biden would finish a second term if reelected in 2024. 55% think Donald Trump would serve a full term. Only 28% say that Biden is physically healthy enough to serve as president for another term. 42% of Americans have a gun in their household, including 55% of Republicans and 31% of Democrats. Among gun owners, 72% say protection is their major reason for owning a gun. And we've got time for a couple of quotes this week. We'll start with Warren Buffett, quoted in Guru Focus. He says, any company that has an economist as one employee, any company that has an economist has one employee too many. And from Martin Luther King Jr., somewhere along the way, we must learn that there is nothing greater than to do something for others. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.